If you hear the word immolation, you probably immediately picture fire.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it's almost impossible not to. But what if I told you that for hundreds of years, the word actually had absolutely nothing to do with burning?
It's one of those linguistic shifts that completely obscures the original meaning. When we look at the stack of sources we've compiled for you today, the origin of that word is actually the master key to understanding the entire phenomenon.
And that is exactly what we are doing today. Welcome to this deep dive.
Yeah.
Today, we are taking a really comprehensive historical and sociological look at one of the most extreme arresting acts a human being can commit.
Right. Self-immolation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I want to acknowledge right up front that we are dealing with some really intense, heavy material here today. But our mission isn't to just, fixate on the shocking headlines you might see on your feed.
Exactly. We want to dig into the profound history, the really stark biological reality, and the complex political evolution behind this act.
Right, because we want to understand how an ancient practice of religious devotion eventually transformed into a modern, widely broadcast geopolitical weapon.
And to do that, we have to look past the flames. We need to examine the deep cultural frameworks and the physiological mechanics at play, because understanding this act reveals something profound about human conviction and about how desperately people seek to break through the normal rhythm of society when they feel completely unheard.
Okay, let's unpack this. Before we can even begin to understand why someone would do this, we need to understand exactly what it is. And like I mentioned at the top, that starts with the surprising etymology of the word itself.
Yeah, so if we trace the English word back to its origins around, say, 1534, the definition was simply killing a sacrificial victim.
So no fire at all.
No inherent connection to fire whatsoever. It actually arrives from the Latin word immolare, which meant to sprinkle with sacrificial meal.
Wait, like meal,
Right.
like food.
Yeah, exactly. Specifically, it referred to a salted flour mixture. They called it mola salsa, and it was used in ancient Roman religion to prepare an offering to the gods.
Oh, wow.
Right. It wasn't until the late 1600s that the word began to figuratively mean destruction, specifically by fire.
That concept of sacrifice, of like making oneself an offering, is going to echo through basically everything we discussed today. But before we get to the philosophy of it, we have to face the physical reality.
Which is incredibly difficult to talk about.
It really is. Our sources detail the harrowing mechanics of what happens to the human body during this act, and it is brutally difficult to comprehend. Frequently, individuals use chemical accelerants, and the initial pain is described as completely excruciating.
But then a very grim biological failsafe kicks in. What's fascinating here is the physiological paradox of it all.
Right.
The sheer overwhelming intensity of the heat eventually burns through the human nerve endings themselves.
Which is just terrifying to think about.
It is. So as the tissue damage becomes the most severe, the individual actually loses physical sensation in those deeply burned areas. But, the flames are just the most visible element. The immediate cause of death during the act itself is very often the inhalation of toxic combustion products and superheated air.
Right, which just destroys the airway.
Exactly.
And for those who survive that initial stage, the body's internal reaction is just catastrophic. Once 25% of an adult's skin is burned, a massive systemic inflammatory response is triggered.
Yeah, the body just goes into complete crisis mode.
I was trying to wrap my head around this, and the best analogy I could think of is like a city's water infrastructure during a massive earthquake. Severe burns cause the body's capillaries to become highly permeable. So imagine a city's water pipe suddenly turning into Swiss cheese. The blood plasma just leaks out everywhere into the surrounding tissue.
That analogy is spot on. The body rapidly loses blood volume and essential fluids because the integrity of the vascular system is just compromised.
Your blood pressure just plummets.
Plummets completely. If that person isn't transported to a specialized burn center within a really critical 4-hour window, the likelihood of dying from sheer physiological shock skyrockets. They essentially die from a massive circulatory
And the
collapse.
statistics are just, they're heavy. You read the medical sources and they lay it out so coldly. If a person is under 40 years old and has burns over less than 80% of their body, they have roughly a 50% chance of survival.
A coin flip, basically.
But the moment those burns exceed 80% coverage, that survival rate drops to just 20%.
And this highlights another crucial psychological paradox of the injuries. because in an accidental fire, a person's biological instinct is to cover their face, right? Or roll on the ground or flee.
Which naturally mitigates the burns.
Right. Those actions lessen the depth of the burns. But in an act of self-immolation, the deliberate refusal of the individual to protect themselves is what produces those abnormally deep burns and the extreme toxic inhalation.
So the body is screaming to survive, and the mind actively overrides it.
Exactly. The mind just shuts down that instinct.
The fact that the body actively fights to survive this makes it clear that doing this requires a level of conviction most of us just can't fathom. So where does conviction that strong even come from?
Well, historically, it wasn't political at all. It was entirely religious. Building on that original etymological idea of a sacrificial offering, we find ancient roots spanning multiple cultures.
Yeah, if we look back centuries, particularly in India, this act is deeply woven into mythology and history. In Hinduism, for instance, you have the foundational myth of Sati.
Right, the goddess Parvati.
Exactly. According to the legend, an incarnation of the goddess Parvati set herself on fire after her father insulted her for marrying Shiva. And Shiva was an ascetic god, meaning a deity associated with severe self-discipline and, you know, abstention from worldly pleasures.
You also see the historical cultural practice of Jauhar in the Mewar region.
Yeah, the Rajput women.
Right. They would undergo mass self-immolation during times of war. This was done specifically to avoid capture, enslavement, and rape by invading armies.
And it wasn't just mythology or wartime desperation either. We have documented historical accounts of philosophers and monks utilizing this act in antiquity. Take the account of Kalanos, an ancient Indian philosopher from Taxila.
Oh, the story with Alexander the Great.
Yes. Around 323 BCE, he actually accompanied Alexander the Great's army. But after falling ill, rather than succumb to disease and lose his physical autonomy, he literally stepped into a pyre and burned himself alive right in front of Alexander and his entire army.
Just incredible. And Kalanos wasn't an isolated case. There's also Sarmanochikus, who was a monk of the Sramana tradition. That was an ancient Indian religious movement focused on asceticism and liberation. He burned himself to death in Athens around 22 BC.
Wow.
Yeah. And as we move eastward into China, the earliest recorded self-immolation occurred in 396 AD by a monk named Fayu.
Right, the one with the incense.
Yes. He informed a ruling prince that he intended to burn himself alive. When the prince tried to intervene, Fayu publicly swallowed incense chips, wrapped his body in oiled cloth, and chanted as he set himself on fire. The historical texts actually describe the witnesses feeling a mixture of both grief and admiration.
Wait, I want to jump in here because reading through the sources, I was really surprised to find this wasn't just an exclusive Buddhist or Hindu practice.
Oh, absolutely not.
Right, you might assume this is purely tied to those specific religious doctrines. But the historian Jimmy Yu examined primary sources from the 16th and 17th centuries in China, and he found something completely different. Taoists and literati officials, so scholars and bureaucrats, they also engaged in ritualistic self-harm.
Yeah, it was much more widespread.
They would burn themselves or expose their naked bodies to the sun for prolonged periods as a form of self-sacrifice, sometimes even to procure rain during droughts. It was embedded in a much broader cultural landscape of using the body as a currency of offering.
And that broader cultural landscape is key to understanding the trigger points. When we analyze the historical record, a very distinct pattern emerges.
Like they don't just happen randomly.
Exactly. These acts don't happen in a vacuum. They often spike during periods of intense crisis, particularly when secular powers become actively hostile toward religion.
Right.
For example, in 7th century China, biographies record 5 monks who self-immolated in the mountains, specifically in response to a harsh systemic persecution of Buddhism by Emperor Wu of Northern Zhou.
So the act becomes a final, undeniable assertion of faith against an overwhelming secular force.
Exactly.
So it begins as a religious offering, a path toward enlightenment, or a desperate defense of faith against a hostile empire. But how does that ancient religious practice pivot into the ultimate modern political weapon? Because as we move into the 20th century, the context shifts dramatically.
It really does. The turning point for the modern era really centers on the South Vietnam Buddhist crisis in 1963. The country's majority Buddhist population was facing intense systemic persecution under the administration of the Catholic president, Ngo Diem. To protest this, several monks took action, most famously Thich Quang Luc, who immolated himself at a very busy intersection in Saigon.
I mean, imagine you are opening your morning newspaper in 1963, and you see that photograph of Thich Quang Ngoc sitting perfectly still, enveloped in flames, while surrounded by a stunned crowd. It is hard to overstate how that image shattered the geopolitical reality of the time.
It really did.
It completely changed how the world viewed the conflict in Vietnam.
And that single act created a massive ripple effect, reaching right into the heart of the United States. Between 1963 and 1971, researchers tracked almost 100 cases of self-immolation covered by major newspapers.
Just in the U.S.?
Yeah, largely connected to protests against the Vietnam War. One of the most prominent was Norman Morrison in 1965. He was an anti-war activist who doused himself in kerosene and set himself on fire directly below the Pentagon office of Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Can an act of such immense, complete physical destruction ever truly be classified as nonviolence? Just because the violence is completely self-directed? I mean, it fundamentally challenges our basic definition of the word.
It really does.
Because a protester setting themselves on fire is, objectively, a violent image.
This raises a very important question, and it's a debate that philosophers and world leaders have grappled with ever since. Interpretations vary wildly depending on the political lens you apply. Take the 14th Dalai Lama, for example.
Okay.
He has argued that self-immolation can be viewed as a practice of nonviolence. His reasoning is that these individuals could easily use explosives to cause mass casualties and harm their opponents, but they consciously choose not to.
Right. They direct it inward.
Exactly. They restrict the ultimate sacrifice entirely to their own lives.
But obviously, not everyone agrees with that classification.
Far from it. In the context of the Tibet and China conflict, where as of 2022, there have been 161 confirmed self-immolations in Tibet, the perspectives are diametrically opposed.
So how do the two sides view it?
Well, the Dalai Lama has characterized the underlying cause of these acts as cultural genocide by Chinese authorities. Conversely, the Chinese government has explicitly blamed the Dalai Lama and his supporters, stating that they are actively inciting and orchestrating these acts.
Right. And the U.S. usually tries to stay in the middle.
The United States, historically, has called on both sides to moderate their stances. But stepping back from the politics of any specific geopolitical conflict, what we see from a sociological perspective is a deep divide in how different cultures define violence and interpret martyrdom.
Which brings us to the final massive shift in this timeline, the globalization of the act in the media age. We see this ancient practice being utilized across radically different cultures for radically different causes. And the sociological mechanics behind why it works are fascinating.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, sociologists classify these events as a form of altruistic suicide.
Altruistic suicide.
Yes. That term is crucial. It differentiates the act from suicide driven by personal despair or mental health struggles. In altruistic suicide, the individual is acting on behalf of a group or a deeply held cause.
Right. It's not about them.
Exactly. The goal is not to cause material damage to infrastructure or to physically harm an opponent. The goal is maximum public visibility. The individual is offering their life to force a collective reckoning. They are using the absolute shock of the act to bypass normal, sluggish political discourse.
And once mass media entered the equation, the visibility of these acts scaled exponentially. We saw it spread to the Soviet bloc in 1968. Protesting against the Warsaw Pact invasion of Czechoslovakia, you had the Polish accountant Jan Palach, who became a massive symbol of resistance.
And then in 1972, a 19-year-old Lithuanian student named Romas Kalanta self-immolated to protest the Soviet regime. That act actually sparked widespread unrest in Lithuania.
And the sheer scale of this in India is hard to wrap your head around.
The statistics from India demonstrate how deeply this method of protest became embedded in certain political movements. In the year 2000 alone, there were as many as 1,451 reported self-immolations.
That is just staggering. Over 1,400 in one year.
It is. Many of these historically have been driven by intensely local domestic issues. For instance, the 1990 protests against caste-based reservations or protests by Tamils against the imposition of the Hindi language in Tamil Nadu. The mechanism is the same, elevating a local grievance to a life or death absolute.
But the most profound example of that mechanism triggering global change has to be the Middle East. The entire Arab Spring, a massive wave of revolutions that toppled multiple entrenched governments across North Africa and the Middle East in 2010 and 2011, was essentially ignited by one man.
Right, Mohamed Bouazizi.
Yes, a street vendor in Tunisia. He self-immolated to protest systemic police harassment and corruption.
And we have to ask how that single act sparked a revolution when so many other protests had failed.
Right, why that one?
The sociological tipping point occurred because Buezi's desperation perfectly mirrored the shared baseline of systemic frustration felt by the wider population. When you have a society already pushed to the brink by economic hardship and corruption, an undeniable altruistic act of supreme sacrifice shatters the apathy.
It wakes everyone up.
Exactly. It strikes directly at the emotional conscience of the public. That single act in Tunisia inspired protests in Algeria, Egypt, and eventually swept across the entire region.
You also see it mobilizing European citizens against modern corruption. In 2013, a Bulgarian photographer and mountaineer named Plemen Goranov set himself on fire in front of the Varna municipal building.
Protesting corruption, right?
Yeah, he was protesting alleged ties between organized crime and local government monopolies. And his death didn't just cause a fleeting moment of sadness. It galvanized massive public outrage.
Yeah.
It led directly to the resignation of both the local mayor and the national government. Citizens spontaneously built a memorial mound of stones at the site of his protest, a deeply symbolic collective display of public grief and solidarity.
And the modernization of how these acts are witnessed continues to evolve right up to this very moment. Think about the progression we've discussed today. We went from ancient monks swallowing incense in front of a small, localized crowd of royalty to the 1960s, where photographs and newspapers shocked the world days later. Today, modern individuals are using instantaneous, borderless, global broadcasting networks. We see this acutely with the recent protests in the United States regarding the ongoing Gaza war.
Yeah, the factual record of recent years shows a stark evolution in methodology. In December 2023, a protester self-immolated outside the Israeli consulate in Atlanta, draped in a Palestinian flag. Then, in February 2024, Aaron Bushnell, an active-duty U.S. Air Force service member, self-immolated outside the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C., in protest against the United States' ongoing support for Israel.
But what marked a truly significant shift in how the act is consumed was that Bushnell actively filmed and live-streamed his own death on the platform Twitch.
He broadcast it live to the world.
Exactly. That live streaming element changed the paradigm entirely. And the incidents continued throughout the year. In September 2024, Matt Nelson self-immolated outside the Israeli consulate in Boston, leaving behind a pre-recorded video urging the U.S. government to stop sending weapons to Israel.
And then there's the incident in D.C.
Right. Just weeks later, in October 2024, a photojournalist named Samuel Mena Jr. survived an attempt to self-immolate at a pro-Palestinian protest in front of the White House. The desire to make the public bear witness remains exactly the same as it was for Kolanos centuries ago.
But the technology ensures the witness pool is now the entire connected globe in real time.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean? We've traced a path from a Latin word describing salted flour through ancient religious devotions in India and China to a deeply visceral, widely broadcast political statement used in Vietnam, Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and modern America. Why should you, listening to this right now, care about something so extreme?
It's a heavy question.
It is, because understanding self-immolation is ultimately about understanding the absolute outer limits of human conviction. It forces us to examine the lengths to which desperate people will go when they feel they have no other way to pierce through the noise of a society that has seemingly stopped listening.
And that leaves us with a critical, somewhat unsettling thought for the future. We live in an era of unprecedented digital information overload.
Oh, for sure.
We can scroll past profound global tragedies on our phones in mere seconds while, you know, waiting in line for coffee. So how will the nature of ultimate protest evolve next?
That is the big question.
If even the most extreme, unimaginable acts of human sacrifice risk getting swept away in the endless, numb churn of a social media feed, how will future generations attempt to make the world stop, look, and actually listen?
A question that definitely lingers long after the flames are gone. We'll leave you to mull that over. Until next time.